India fears the government is using this law and other similar laws to widen crackdown on them.
India introduced this bill in 2016 with the aim of granting citizenship to what it calls a persecuted section of refugees. However, the bill has become one of the most controversial issues across the country since it excludes Muslims from availing citizenship. Critics accuse the ruling BJP of targeting a particular community on the basis of faith, which experts call unconstitutional.
Commentators also question the exclusion of persecuted religious minorities from other regions such as Tibet, Sri Lanka and Myanmar. India's Interior Ministry has said in a statement, those eligible can now apply online for Indian citizenship. The issue has been one of the key pledges of Indian Prime Minister since assuming office in 2014. The new legislation makes changes to more than six decades old Indian citizenship law.
It's unfortunate for us that we are not part of this new law, despite the fact we have faced worse persecution any community has faced so far. We have still hope one day India will accept us on the ground of humanity.
Opposition political parties have accused the ruling party of influencing the elections, saying the move is to polarize the voters, considering its timing. More than 200 petitions challenging the law are still pending before the court of law.
We thank India they provide us shelter. It's an act of kindness, but we urge this country not to abandon us, knowing the fact we have seen deadly violence and persecution.
India, home to roughly 200 million Muslims, have recently seen targeted attacks and vicious hate campaigns. Critics accuse the ruling party of mixing religion with politics, resonating with India's majority. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
Russia Navy Warship and China Navy Warship. This is Iranian Navy Warship 235. I call you on channel 16. Do you read me? Over.
The Maritime Security Belt 2024 has officially kicked off with Russian and Chinese vessels entering Iran's territorial waters south of the country on Tuesday. The naval and airborne units of Iran's army and the IRGC, along with their Chinese and Russian counterparts, will participate in various operations during this exercise. Naval delegations from Azerbaijan, Pakistan, Kazakhstan, Oman and South Africa have also taken part as observer states. At the first stage of the drill, the naval officers of the three countries as well as the observer states reviewed different phases of the exercise on maps and held tactical briefings. Later, the naval commanders of Iran, Russia and China held a joint presser. The Iranian Navy's deputy commander said the main aim of the joint exercise is to help safeguard security in the northern part of the Indian Ocean.
Upholding peace and security in the north of Indian Ocean and having a specialized cooperation in combating piracy and terrorism in our region are among the main goals of this exercise. We are constantly working to improve this cooperation.
Meanwhile, Chinese and Russian Navy commanders said the joint exercise further demonstrates the preparedness of the participating countries to maintain security while also deepening their practical cooperation. 2024 is the fifth consecutive year that the Islamic Republic of Iran's Navy is hosting countries participating in the Maritime Security Belt drills in the northern Indian Ocean region.
This year's naval drills have kicked off under the motto Together for Peace and Security, with participating countries highlighting the importance of jointly safeguarding regional security. Mahdi Abbasian, Konarak.
This is not the first time Palestinian people are spending Ramadan under Israeli aggression. In 2014, the Israeli regime also waged a destructive war on Gaza during the holy month. However, the current genocidal war is unprecedented in terms of its colossal casualties. Many Palestinians have become orphans and widows and lost their children. The memory of their loved ones will stay with them in Ramadan.
The life here is so difficult. The holy month of Ramadan is around the corner and we are still displaced from our homes and our families are torn apart. We have nothing to eat for iftar. I'm originally from Gaza. I've lost 37 members of my family. They were so close to my heart. Every time I remember them, my gut is wrenched and I become so sad and furious.
With markets destroyed and goods scarce, Gazans don't know where their iftar meals will come from, which means more suffering and agony. The vast majority of the people live in small tents amid the starvation that has already claimed the lives of several Palestinian children.
The situation in Gaza is very difficult. There is no food. The people are struggling to find anything to eat with flour scarce. Here in the south, they queue in long lines for food. Even those who attempt to get anything from the aid trucks are putting their lives at risk as Israeli soldiers open fire on them. I don't know what we're going to do in Ramadan.
Palestinians' catastrophe doesn't stop with the loss of their relatives. It is deepened by the full-scale destruction that has become palpable in every corner of Gaza, including mosques, which means they won't be able to say their prayers and worships as usual. Even if their mosques hadn't been destroyed, it would still be impossible for them to perform their prayers under the incessant Israeli bombardments.
The humanitarian conditions are completely disastrous. The people were displaced from several parts of Gaza, including the northern and central areas of the Strip. It is literally catastrophic. There is no source of income or food, and the people are completely relying on the small amounts of donation provided by a limited numbers of charity institutions. In addition to that, mosques have been completely destroyed by Israeli warplanes and we will never be able to pray in them.
While some aid has been trickling into Gaza, it's minuscule compared to the needs of the Palestinians. With Ramadan arriving, more assistance cannot come soon enough for them.
As the whole Muslim nation welcomes Ramadan, Palestinians are wondering why they have been abandoned by many Muslim leaders to face the Israeli campaign of death and starvation. To Abu Musabbih, the central area of Gaza Strip.
The Iranian National Oil and Gas Company says that this is the most strategic project in the history of Iran's oil and gas industry and its long-sought empowerment of domestic entities. Under this project, 90 trillion cubic feet of gas and 2 billion barrels of gas condensates will be available for use. Top Iranian companies, Petropars, Oil Industries Engineering and Construction, Khatam al-Anbiya Construction Headquarters, Mapna Group, and a consulting company are the contractors of the mega project.
In the subject matter of the development and increase of capacities of the gas and oil refineries, we witnessed the second phase of Abadan refinery with the capacity of 210,000 barrels, which helped the production and supply of gas in the country. In the 14th phase of the South Pars refineries, 50 million cubic feet of gas is produced per day, which again adds to the capacity of gas production in the country.
The massive project has created an opportunity to kickstart economic prosperity and employment in the face of unilateral Western sanctions. This has also allowed Iranian producers and companies to engage greatly in the economic growth and industrial development of the country and neutralize the sanctions.
Today, all Iranian people should witness the fact that the surrounding nations trust the Iranian National Oil Company and the relative competent companies and contractors and do rely on them, because they know well that the South Pass was built by Iranian companies, and the day that they thought that it was impossible to do so without the help and presence of foreigners, that exact day was the day that South Pass became what it is today.
While sanctions have forced the governing bodies to change their attitude towards domestic companies and entrust them with tasks, it should be noted that Iranian producers are not perennial supporters of sanctions. Rather, they would like to interact and acquire world-class technologies from foreign companies to empower themselves. with contracts for developing oil and gas field sites and projects for boosting pressure in South Pars gas field being started, Iran is experiencing yet another success in the mega gas project to exploit the immense gas field. Fateh Masumi, Tehran.
Chants echoed through the streets of the Pakistani capital Islamabad as thousands of demonstrators gathered to condemn the United States and Israel.
Ceasefire now!
The protest, organized by Pakistan's largest religio-political party, Jamaat-e-Islami, saw passionate crowds marching through the streets, expressing solidarity with the Palestinian cause and denouncing Israel's actions, which take place with the support of the U.S.
Of course, there should be a ceasefire long ago, but even now we are pressing for it, and you have seen how irresponsible and insensitive Biden has been responding. He was just having ice cream and talking about ceasefire as if it was a very casual affair. And on the other hand, the way children are dying, women are dying from morning till night, and especially there are a lot of prisoners which are taken by Israel. And there are large number of women and children who have been taken as prisoners, and their condition is pathetic.
The acts of solidarity in Pakistan reflect widespread outrage and sympathy for the plight of the Palestinian people.
As a Pakistani citizen, I think that our government should immediately call for a ceasefire and boycott all the products that are supporting the Israeli aggression in Palestine. And I also want to say that the whole world should come out of their houses and protest, because the kids, Palestinian kids, are starving right now, and they are being starved, and they are scared, and they are homeless, and they have nothing to eat and drink, and they are dying. And how can anybody bear that?
The protesting Pakistanis called on the government to cut its ties with the U.S. over what they call the barbaric role in the killing of innocent men, women and children in Gaza.
People here in Pakistan are concerned about the ongoing atrocities committed by Israeli forces in Gaza. They are demanding that the international community enforce an immediate ceasefire by bringing the U.S. and Israel to the International Court of Justice for their war crimes in Gaza. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
Syrians have long been accustomed to eagerly welcoming the holy month of Ramadan, brimming with joy and happiness. But this year has brought an unusual sense of sadness as the harsh economic conditions exacerbated by unjustified Western sanctions is casting a shadow over their celebrations. Moreover, their hearts are heavy with sorrow for their brethren in Gaza, who endure the devastating consequences of the ongoing Israeli onslaught.
We are going through a painful situation as people do not have money due to the poor economic conditions. As store owners, we are trying to consider the people's circumstances by reducing prices during Ramadan. However, basic production materials are expensive due to the importing difficulties.
Ramadan is always a special month, as it is a month of worship, patience and blessings, especially in Palestine. However, this year, it is as if Palestinians in Gaza have been fasting for more than 5 months. We pray for them and gain our determination, patience and steadfastness from them, from the brave faces of Gaza's children, the resilience of its resistance fighters, and the patience of its steadfast women.
Ramadan comes this year while the Western world, which claims freedom and humanity, practices double standards with the people of Gaza, who are suffering from hunger, blockade, and Israeli crimes. Palestinians are paying the price for demanding their freedom and legitimate rights. Syrians will always stand with them until the final victory over the Zionist regime and the liberation of the occupied lands.
The month of Ramadan comes this year amid the continued unjust Western economic blockade on Syria. We see our people in Gaza suffering from blockade, hunger, killing, destruction, and continuous Zionist aggression without deterrent.
Syrians are a living nation because they have defended resistance, and the Palestinian people are the soul of resistance. We say to the West, you will lose, and the access of resistance from Iran to Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Palestine, and Yemen will prevail. We will break the Caesar Act and all your blockades on Syria and Gaza, and we will all pray in Al-Quds.
Syrian message to their brothers and sisters in Gaza is that no matter how difficult our circumstances may be, your tragedy in Gaza remains even more challenging, and your resilience is an inspiration not only for us, but for all free people around the world.
Syrians welcome Ramadan this year amid hard economic conditions due to unjust Western sanctions and with heavy hearts for their besieged brothers and sisters in Gaza. Yet their commitment to the resistance fuels their faith in eventual victory. Ibrahim Wahdi, Damascus.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
Supplication on Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness, and I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets and thy messengers whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change. And that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive. And make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty ones.
Sound from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The U.S. Israeli genocidal war is setting records. In addition to dropping one of the largest volumes of bombs and munitions on the civilian population, which has been compared to the nuclear bomb that the U.S. dropped in Hiroshima, the U.N. has said that the number of children killed during the first 4 months of the war has topped all those killed in 4 years of wars across the globe. In this edition of the program, we will look at how the U.S. and its allies are looking to give off the impression of doing a good deed with airdropping food or delivering aid to Gaza, while rifts between the U.S. President Joe Biden and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu are widening over the aggression overall. Let me introduce our guest for this edition of the program. Seth Nimmer is a professor of political science at Birzeit University who joins us from Ramallah. Also joining us is Sam Parker, political activist who ran against Mitt Romney for the U.S. Senate, joining us from Salt Lake City, Utah. Welcome to you both. Seth Nimmer, first over to you. This is a very shocking and grim stat. Coming from Philippe Lazzarini, I'm sure you heard of him, the Commissioner General of UNRWA, War on Children. He said a war on their childhood and their future. The number of children reported killed in just over 4 months is higher than the number of children killed in 4 years of wars around the world combined. What's your impression of what he has said?
We know that what was going on in Gaza, this aggression against Gaza, it's a genocide. It's not even a war like any other war, because the Israelis, they don't have any intelligence about what's going on in Gaza underground. And since they lack of information, what they are doing is just these bombardments. And definitely, when you are talking about 2.2 million people living in a very small area, not more than 365 square kilometers, then definitely there will be a very high casualty among the civilians. And since Palestinians in general, whether in Gaza or in the West Bank and in Jerusalem, 52% of our population are under 18 years old. So we are talking about 52% of our population are children. So wherever you hit, definitely half of the casualties will be children, and definitely the others will be also women. So women and children so far are more than 70% of the casualties in this aggression or genocide. So because of that, definitely the number of children, we are talking about more than 12,000 so far of children were killed because of these bombardments. That's not to mention those who were severely injured and those who became handicapped because of limbs being cut off, or hands, right, or legs, or these kind of things, in addition to the last numbers of children who are dying because of hunger.
Taking a look at the stat that you just heard, I'm wondering what you think about this, Sam Parker, when there are two things that stand out here. Just as recent as a few weeks ago, the U.S. was reported to send weapons to Israel amid this invasion threat in the Rafah area. And this planned delivery of bombs and other munitions comes also on the heels of another report that came out by the Washington Post. If you heard about those, contracts that were hidden, not revealed, where, again, bombs and munitions were sent, which has contributed to this number of children that have been killed in the Gaza Strip. What do you think about the U.S. administration and the assistance that they're given to the Israeli regime militarily?
Yeah, that's a good question. I appreciate you having me on. But absolutely, it's very duplicitous, and obviously it's a lot of optics, and it's a PR stunt, essentially. I have a picture saved on my computer that I saw a few days ago that was circulating online of the parachute airdrop of the food with bombs blowing up buildings in the background in Gaza. In the same picture, U.S. Food pallets drifting down out of the sky and bombs falling and blowing up buildings and people. So the United States is engaged in doing both things and playing both sides, but really they're just playing one side. They're playing the Israel side because they've been sending all kinds of bombs and munitions over to Israel to drop on Gaza and to use in this conflict. It's not a war, right? This is not a war. People are calling it a war, but it's not a war because Gaza doesn't have armed forces, so to speak. It doesn't have tanks and planes and attack helicopters and armored personnel carriers and infantry and Marines and all these things. It's not a conventional war. It's mostly just 2.2 million civilians just getting bombed from here to there and everywhere by the most modern weaponry known to mankind. And the United States has been covertly sending this without the knowledge of Congress, circumventing Congress without congressional approval. And now to sort of save face, to curry favor with their voter base, and to not look so bad on the international stage, they're doing these stunts like dropping a couple truckloads worth of food that really don't amount to much. The first airdrop only had 38,000 meals, which if you think about it, 38,000 meals, how does that begin to feed a population of 2.2 million people who are literally now starving to death? The latest figures I've heard are about 600,000 Gazans are at catastrophic levels of starvation right now. And so a couple truckloads of aid delivered, that's just a PR stunt, especially when, as you pointed out, it's being done at the same time that we're sending just truckloads of bombs and munitions, and many of them in secret. So it's duplicitous. It's just a PR stunt. And I think it signals an unseriousness from the Biden administration.
Sam Nimmerbauer just talked about this food drops that have occurred, how minimal they are. It's quite mind-boggling when you think about what he said, where you have the food drops and you have bombs in the background that are blowing up buildings that have civilians inside of it. I mean, one has to scratch their head and say, what can we do? What can be done? There's not a phone call that you can make because obviously this genocide continues. But then you have the other side, another ally as a whole, the EU, who although has critiqued Israel, they have come out with a maritime food corridor. I don't know, have you seen that barge that's carrying what is said to be 200 tons of aid? That doesn't look like it even holds thousands of Palestinians. Why are they doing this when such minimal amounts of food going to the Strip in the first place, and B, when you have the crossings that have trucks waiting there to go inside the Strip? What's the deal there?
Yes, I do agree with your guest from Utah that it is a BR thing, because we know that in Gaza we have 5 crossings for goods between Israel and the Gaza Strip. We are talking about Kisufim, Sofa, and Karni, apart from Rafah crossing with Egypt, and apart from Erez, which is also for personnel. But for goods, there are 4 other crossings between Israel and Gaza Strip. So if the Americans and other Arab countries and some European countries can drop and have the agreement of Israel to drop some of the goods by air, I think they should, you know, force them or agree with them to open the crossings and to get in all the goods normally as it used to be before the 7th of October. Before the 7th of October, we were talking about 500 trucks or shipments coming to Gaza every day. Now we are talking about only 100 and only through Rafah. So it's absolutely absurd. So it's a BR thing. It's not nothing more than that. And then the American came with this brilliant idea about, you know, making a kind of a port into Gaza, and they ordered the military to do it. It needs something like 3 months to be established. 3 months. What will happen to the people who are starving now in 3 months' time? This is, I think, also, it is because the Israeli, they don't want the UNRWA to be involved. And this is part of the war on the UNRWA. So now they are talking about alternative organizations to deliver the aid to the Palestinians. And they want to, you know, ignore the UNRWA because from their point of view, the UNRWA is helping the Palestinian resistance, which is not true at all. And it's we know the aim by the Israeli, sure, why they are targeting the UNRWA, because it is the organization that is keeping the right for the Palestinians to return and to their land, and that's why they have this war against it. And the Americans are involved in that. When they just, you know, cut all the aid to the UNRWA just lately, and during Trump era also they did that before.
Okay.
It's targeting the UNRWA.
Yeah, we could talk about the logistics and how ridiculous it sounds, thinking that this is going to work better than the land routes, which UN has said that, Sam Parker, that land routes are obviously the way to go. But we got to move on to another topic of this U.S. military assessment that came out, this intel report, just very recent. And I'm going to combine two issues into one. One, it said Hamas, on Hamas, Israel probably will face lingered armed resistance from Hamas for years to come. And then you have, on another note, how Israeli regime forces suffering defeat on the battlefield. There's plans to lift military service exemption of these ultra-Orthodox Jews. Do you think that they are losing that on the battlefield? And combined with this report, that is one thing they want to do, is to keep feeding the regime forces side of things in order to continue the genocide?
Well, it certainly looks that way. And I saw the protests from these Orthodox Jews in Israel that erupted last week, where they were blocking highways for several hours at a time. And you had conflict, physical conflict going on between Israeli police officers and the Orthodox protesters. And this is an idea that's been building for the last month or two inside of Israel. I think Itamar Ben-Gvir has been pushing for this. He hasn't wanted to make it a force of law yet, but they've absolutely been pushing this idea of drafting these people into the service who have traditionally been exempted. So that does signal that they are short on manpower, that they do want to prolong this conflict. And I think, you know, going back to the last topic of this aid package that's coming from Europe through the maritime corridor, that's, I guess, going to be delivered onto this temporary pier that the United States is constructing. It's going to take 2 months to build that pier, minimum. And so that signals right there, that's a soft signal that this assault on Gaza is going to last at least for another couple months, even though you have Benjamin Netanyahu saying maybe 4, maybe 6 weeks, but the United States is counting on at least 2 months. So,
do you think that's by design? I'm sorry to jump in. Do you think they've designed it that way in order to have that 2 months or 3 months maybe for the, I don't know, for Israel to be able to do its military maneuvers on the ground?
Absolutely. I think they're giving cover to Israel. There's no question about it. Look, Benny Gantz, one of, you know, the leader of the opposition party, the National Unity Party, who is thought of as one of the major rivals to Benjamin Netanyahu, made a visit to Washington, D.C. last week, basically with the coordination of the Biden administration to help the Biden administration politically to take heat off of them, but also to signal that they still support Israel, but take heat off of their relationship with Benjamin Netanyahu and put forward a positive, you know, we're just against terrorism in general, and we support Israel. So I think there are a lot of political moves being made. This is a PR stunt. And some have even suggested that this pier will become a permanent pier that Israel will use once they completely take over Gaza once and for all. So I do think that this is a stunt because, as you said, as has been said by the other guest, there's 5 crossings into Gaza already with food trucks ready to go. It doesn't make any sense.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
All right, this U.S. military intel report said there needs a little bit more opening up. And one of the things it has said is the fact that there's distrust on Netanyahu by the masses, Israeli masses, and that the protests are going to swell up even after the genocidal war ends, and they're going to demand Netanyahu's resignation, and that may actually force him to leave office. Do you believe that Netanyahu is on his last legs?
Okay. I think that, yes, Netanyahu is facing really a big problem now inside Israel. Last week, there was a poll conducted in Israel, and most of the population in Israel, for 53% of those who were conducted in the poll, they said that we believe now that Netanyahu is making the war now going on and on for his own personal reasons, not for the sake of Israel. Otherwise, he should agree to the deal to release the prisoners captive by the Palestinian resistance, but he's doing that for his own personal issues, knowing that he's going after that to the, to face the court and maybe also prison, but definitely not being a prime minister anymore after Gantz being even welcomed in America, and that was really make Netanyahu very, very angry with that, because now the Americans are dealing with Gantz as the next prime minister in Israel. Now, in Israel itself, there are now, and it's unprecedented, it's for the very first time ever in a war in Israel that you see this fragmentation in the Israeli society. A part of that is the families of the captive prisoners in Gaza. On the other hand, you have people of, especially the mothers and families of the soldiers killed in Gaza, and the numbers are really very high, though the Israeli are not announcing it quite right. And they are demanding that we don't want our children to be killed now in Gaza anymore. Mm-hmm. And also you have another pressure coming from those who were removed from north of Palestine, because of Hezbollah in Lebanon, and those who removed from the south of Palestine because of the aggression on Gaza. So sure. Now you are talking about lots of problems that Netanyahu is facing, and all these are elements of pressure on Netanyahu. So yeah, I believe that he had to finish this job by the end of the day, because there is lots of pressure coming from other countries and from the Americans. The problem with Netanyahu, my last sentence, the problem with Netanyahu, if he go to a ceasefire, he's admitting the defeat of Israel for the second time in this aggression.
Interesting point you make there. Sam Parker, the rift between Bibi and Biden. I mean, is it real? Is it deep? Is it as bad as these red lines for Rafah, where Biden has put it out there, taken it back, but put it out there again? That they're on a collision course. I mean, even there's this, again, intel report that's saying a senior Israeli official, on the condition of anonymity, revealing that the U.S. is actually seeking to oust the Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu. Are we looking at what is being reported to be real when it comes to the two?
There may be a rift between the administration and Netanyahu, but I don't think that there's a fundamental rift between the U.S. administration and Israel itself and the policy and its current policies and its current warmongering. I don't think there's a rift there. I don't think that the United States is going to stand in the way of what Israel wants to do. Now, Netanyahu has become is starting to become more of a political liability. Look, in Israel, like the other guest just said, he's deeply unpopular. He was already unpopular before October 7th. There were massive protests out in the streets of Jerusalem Some say that Israel was even on the brink of civil war. And since then, they blame Netanyahu for the debacle of October 7th. They blame him for the death of these hostages. They're furious with him that he won't negotiate to bring the hostages home. And that they know that Israel has likely killed some of their own hostages. So he's even more unpopular than he was before, and he was deeply unpopular before. It's just that, you know, in the middle of a war, it's hard to make, you know, a change like that. So I don't think that there is a red line. I think that politically this is hurting the Joe Biden administration, and it's hurting his reelection campaign. And I think that any rhetoric that seeks to diminish Benjamin Netanyahu or to put forth any idea of a red line is really to serve his base that is mad at him for supporting a genocide. And so I think it's going toward his reelection campaign. I don't think it shifts a fundamental change. I don't think it signals a fundamental shift in U.S. policy towards helping Israel do what it wants to do. Look, this, we just said this pier, it's going to take 2 months. That gives Israel cover it needs the cover it needs for at least the next couple or 3 months. So sure. I think it's mostly rhetoric and to take heat off him for his reelection campaign.
Well, Saad Nimr, the U.S. President Joe Biden was very sure and confident that there would be a ceasefire. He even announced the day of the week, Monday, a few days prior to Ramadan. We saw that didn't happen. Now, one of the reasons, was the insistence by Hamas to have a permanent ceasefire. It did not want a temporary one. What's wrong with that? Why should that have been one of the thorny issues that some are saying that led to the ceasefire not to happen?
Yeah, well, let's put it just, bluntly like this. What they wanted Hamas to deliver all the prisoners, to give them back, and which is the only card in their hands, Hamas, and then they will continue the war. So what's the purpose then? Definitely Hamas is not going to give all these 134 prisoners that they have for only a ceasefire. And when they deliver them, the Israeli will continue and resume the killing and the war against Gaza. So definitely they will insist on a ceasefire. And there is a huge understanding anyway among all those who are involved in this negotiation with that. And they believe that there should be a ceasefire. The problem here is the Netanyahu himself. Now, for the Americans, yes, I do agree with Sam. When we are talking about the deep state in the United States, definitely they are going to back up Israel and always will support Israel. But sometimes you have between the administration and the government in Israel some problems. And we saw that also during Obama. So it might happen like that. But it is not that deep rift in the relationship, which would make Biden force Israel to do something they don't want to do. Mm-hmm. We know that Biden can, in half an hour, order Israel to stop the war, and they will stop it. Otherwise, we won't give you anything. So if they want to do it, they can do it. But they are involved, and they are still going on with Israel in this war. So this pressure by Biden to achieve a kind of a ceasefire before Ramadan, okay, it failed. And who failed it was Netanyahu, because he insisted, and he withdrew his delegation from Egypt in the last moment, and he don't want to continue negotiations.
Sure.
And he's blaming Hamas. So, yeah, we think it's not that much of negotiations anyway, since they are sticking to their opinion.
1 minute. We keep hearing about how the U.S. can pick up the phone, Sam Parker, and tell the war, the onslaught to stop. We hear that a lot. But we don't hear the fact that the U.S., with all the military assistance it's given, has not been able to help Israel win the onslaught. Why do you think that is? Less than a minute, please.
Well, I think the goal hasn't been to quote unquote win, because I think Israel wants that land and it wants to move the people off the land. It also wants to have exact retribution and revenge for what happened on October 7th. And so they're starving these people. They're collectively punishing them. They're systematically destroying all civilizational infrastructure, hospitals, schools, mosques, churches, apartments, homes, everything, roads. There's nothing left in many parts of Gaza. So they're not fighting a war. They're not fighting a conventional war where we're trying to beat the enemy and take out its enemy force, so much as that they're trying to clear out the land, ethnically cleanse them, and take it over. That's been their goal. And so I think while they project the idea of winning.
Thank you very much, Sam Parker, political activist, ran against Mitt Romney for the U.S. Senate, Salt Lake City, Utah. Saad Nimr, a pleasure, professor of political science Brzezet University from Ramallah. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Miko Batawe and the team, it's goodbye.
From east to west, throughout the vast land of Iran, you're listening to IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
The European Union Environment Agency is saying countries across Europe should be prepared for catastrophic risks, ranging from floods to deadly heat waves, as worsening climate change hits every part of their economies and societies. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. The European Environment Agency, the EEA, has said in its first risk assessment, Europe is not prepared for the rapidly growing climate risk that it faces. From wildfires burning down homes to violent weather straining public finances, the report says more action is needed to address half of the 36 significant climate risks with potentially severe consequences that it identifies for Europe. The report says five more risks need urgent attention. Lina Ilamononen, the EEA's executive director, said, "Our new analysis shows that Europe faces urgent climate risks that are growing faster than our societal preparedness." The report looks at how severe the climate threats are and how Europe is to deal with them. It says the most pressing risks, which are growing worse as fossil fuel pollution heats the planet, are heat stress, flash floods and river floods, the health of coastal and marine ecosystems, and the need for solidarity funds to recover from disasters. When the researchers reassessed six of the risks for southern Europe, which they described as a hotspot region, they found urgent action was also needed to keep crops safe and to protect people, buildings and nature from wildfires. Robert Biesbroek, a report author from Wageningen University in the Netherlands, who also co-led the chapter on Europe in the latest Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report on adaptation, said, "There is increasing evidence of adaptation, but it's certainly not enough." Robert Biesbroek said, "It's not going quickly enough and it's not reaching the ones that need it most. It's quite scary in that sense." The report also warns of cascading and compounding risks, which it says current stress tests in the financial sector are likely to underestimate. For instance, hot weather will dry out southern Europe, killing crops and shrinking water supplies, but will also harden soils, making flash floods more likely and dry out vegetation, meaning wildfires can spread faster in southern Europe. Governments trying to respond to several crises will be more stretched for resources, as will communities that fail to prepare. Blaz Koenig, the head of the European Environment Agency's Impacts and Adaptation Group, said, "The risks are simply outpacing the developments of policies." Europe has heated up more than any other continent since the Industrial Revolution. It has heated about twice as fast as the global average, as carbon dioxide has clogged the atmosphere and trapped sunlight. The researchers looked at two possible scenarios of low and high warming over the century. They did not consider potential tipping points in the climate system, arguing that the effects of such dramatic changes would unfold over longer time periods, and so did not change the urgency of action in the short term. Daniela Schmidt of Bristol University, who sat on the advisory board of the report but was not involved in writing of the report, said the geographical granularity that the report offered was important, but questioned whether another report on risk was needed. She said, "Will it increase the action? Will it make people more ready to have more information about what those key risks for us are looking like?" Daniela Schmidt, who also co-led the chapter on Europe for the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report on adaptation, said people should understand that governments, cities and individuals had agency to reduce risks, and that actions to do so would come with benefits such as cleaner air and better housing. She said, "How can we facilitate that people know they have the power to do something?" The European Commission said it would present a communication on managing climate risk recently. The European Environment Agency report says several climate risks have already reached critical levels. It says if decisive action is not taken now, most climate risks could reach critical or catastrophic levels by the end of this century. Lena Ilamanonen said this should be the final wake-up call. The Reuters news agency has also covered the same story and tells us more. The European Union Environment Agency said on Monday, 11th of March, countries across Europe should prepare for catastrophic risks ranging from floods to deadly heat waves as worsening climate change hits every part of their economies and societies. The Copenhagen-based body said in its first Europe-wide analysis of climate-related risks, policymakers need to draw up new plans to address the challenges ahead. The European Environment Agency said Europe is the world's fastest warming continent, heating up at twice the global average. Even if countries manage to slow global warming, global temperatures are already more than 1 degree Celsius higher than pre-industrial times. The European Environment Agency said the damage will depend in part on whether policymakers act now to prepare societies, for example, by improving insurance coverage, redesigning infrastructure, and introducing laws to protect outdoor workers from deadly heat. Without more urgent action, the European Environment Agency said most of the 36 climate risks facing Europe could hit critical or catastrophic levels this century. They include risks to health, crop production, and infrastructure. In a pessimistic scenario, by the end of the century, the European Environment Agency said hundreds of thousands of people would die from heat waves, and economic losses from coastal floods alone could exceed 1 trillion euros per year. That would far exceed the 650 billion euros lost to weather and climate-related extremes across the European bloc from 1980 to 2022. Kate Levick, Associate Director of climate think tank E3G, urged governments to respond to the European Environment Agency's findings. Kate Levick said, "There's a particular role for finance ministers to essentially look at what happens to balance sheets in terms of assets and liabilities at national level as a result of climate risk." The European Commission will publish its response to the report in the coming days. According to a draft European Commission communication seen by Bloomberg News Agency, Europe stands to suffer significant economic effects amounting to some 7% of its output by the end of the century, even if the world manages to contain the increase of global temperatures to 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. The European Environment Agency's report argues that climate change will be even more acute in southern Europe, including Greece, with the average temperature in the continent rising by a considerable 3 degrees Celsius in the scenario of a global rise by 1.5 degrees Celsius. The blueprint further warns that in case global warming exceeds 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels, the impact will be even more dramatic, with the European Union economy standing to lose some 2.4 trillion euros from its gross domestic product between 2031 and 2050.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Thank you. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.